you know, I'm here on behalf of Calvin Bailey. He was convicted in the Norfolk Circuit Court of grand larceny. It's somewhat of a convoluted
Let me make your argument really concise here, if I can, because it seems to me this is a very, very narrow issue, and somebody is either calling in or we're calling out. I'm not sure what's going on. In any event, we have an owner who testified that the fair market value of his stolen bicycle was exactly the same amount of money he paid for it. He based that on the condition it was in and the fact that that was the replacement cost. Now, we have some competing jurisprudence out there, it seems to me. We have the jurisprudence that says in a situation like this, depreciation has to be accounted for. And we also have a situation that says the owner is, as a matter of law, competent to testify to the value of stolen property. Here, the owner, in effect, said, based on the condition of the bicycle, depreciation was zero. Now, you might think, and I might think, that that's kind of nonsense, but that's the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth.
Well, you've added, you've kind of dressed it up a little bit sometimes, Judge, and the devil, as one of my colleagues like to say quite often, is in the detail. What the owner actually said was, you know, I bought this bicycle 4 years ago in Greece, a little over 4 years ago, and I paid $518. He was asked by the judge, what do you think you'd have to pay to replace it? And he said, I guess $500.
Seated to my right here is the Court of Appeals' foremost authority on the value of bicycles.
Well, and so,
who rides a $518 bike?
But in any event, I mean, you know, the case that governs this, I cited Baylor. She cited, I think, Little, and we've got all these things where courts engage in syllogisms to try to come out with the general rule in these proceedings is the Commonwealth wins. You know, we always look, and I'm not fighting that particular principle. We always look for the what evidence was before the trial court that would allow it to reach the conclusion it did, and if we can affirm on that basis, you do. And I understand that, and they get every inference that they can possibly draw.
Mr. Crack, I know you didn't try this case, but you know, I see these transcripts all the time, and it never ceases to amaze me that when this happens, and it happens frequently, the owner gets on there and says, this is what I think the property is worth. They may be picking numbers out of the air, probably are picking numbers out of the air, but nobody is really challenging them on it. And nobody is on cross-examination saying, you just made up that number, didn't you, or whatever. So we have what we have.
I understand. Of course, so this is the problem here, and I read the Commonwealth's brief with great interest, but the problem is we start with several different issues. One, the purchase price is always admissible, generally in these cases, as some evidence of the fair market value. Secondly, the owner gets to testify as to what he thinks the value is, even if he has no basis whatsoever. And as the courts have said, quite often the weight that can be given to that is trifling, which means it's not worth a peppercorn, if I ever figured out from law school what the heck the value of a peppercorn was. But what the courts are saying is, as a matter of policy, the owner gets to tell us what he thinks it's worth. But it really doesn't carry a lot of weight unless there's a valid basis for it.
Well, wait a minute. Is this a question, and I think this relates to Judge Humphrey's question. Is this a question, first and foremost, of admissibility?
No, sir.
Or is it purely a question of weight? So the owner can simply say, without any basis, I think it's worth $1,000.
It can.
That's admissible?
That's admissible. According to the case law, if you read the whole line of cases, that's what it says.
Is there any other expert witness that can simply state a conclusion without any basis, foundation?
No, I don't know any other place in the law where we let somebody stand there and simply say,
because it seems to me all these cases about value, there's at least some rationale behind why.
Well, I think the one step we're jumping over, and that was what I was trying to get to, was the courts have recognized just because you put out purchase value and the owner states an opinion, you still have to have due allowance for a depreciation and wear and usage. And that's always an overlay, and contrary to what Ms. Darrow said in her brief, it's the burden of the Commonwealth. It's not for the defense to raise it in cross-examination. It's not for it to put on affirmative evidence.
No, but the Commonwealth arguably met that burden here, at least implicitly, when the owner said a couple of things. He said what he paid for it, and you've conceded that's admissible. You've conceded that he can opine as to the opinion. That's certainly admissible. And he also said it was in really good condition.
Excellent condition.
Excellent condition, and that implies at least that its value, at least as far as his opinion is concerned, was to the dollar exactly what it was.
What I've got, I think it's worth $518 because that's what I paid for it. But that is not an opinion that takes in due allowance, and it's a Commonwealth burden.
But your earlier point was that if that's admissible because the case law says it's admissible, and it's purely an issue of weight, we don't reweigh these things. The fact finder credited that. There was no evidence to the contrary. And
there was no need for evidence because it's their burden.
I get that, but from the appellate standpoint, that's in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, we have competent evidence that the fact finder gave credibility to that this property is worth more than $200, and that ends our analysis.
That's not a credibility issue because basically part of their burden is show items that are subject to wear and depreciation.
The word burden here is the one that I think is critical. The burden is on the Commonwealth to establish value. The burden is on the defendant to challenge the means by which the value was estimated. The burden is on the defendant to say, wait a minute, Your Honor, that value does not take into account depreciation, so therefore I object to its admissibility.
It's not an admissibility issue. It's a question. It is a question of whether the sufficiency of the evidence, the way the Supreme Court has defined this particular issue. We've got rules in here. We've got admissibility of evidence that's not otherwise admissible in any other context simply because we want to let the owner get on the stand as a matter
of policy. The degree of depreciation? Who is required to establish
that? The Commonwealth is, and that's right out of Dunn, and that's out of this whole line.
Depreciation can be either substantial or it can be negligible, depending on the circumstances.
But that's their burden to show.
I agree.
And they didn't show anything. What they showed here was a four-year, a brand-new bicycle.
Let me interrupt you, Mr. McCracken. I think we're talking past each other, and see if you can agree with this. The burden of the Commonwealth is to establish the elements of the offense. The only element in question we're talking about here is the fair market value of a stolen bicycle, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, the record reflects that value at the time of its theft was $518.
And that's where we disagree.
And that's where you disagree.
That's the point of disagreeing.
But the question, though, is that evidence was admitted, and it was admitted without objection. Okay, and so we have, from our appellate perspective here, in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, the Commonwealth has met its burden of establishing the fair market value of this bicycle being over $200. Now, whether that opinion should have come in the first instance is what Judge Petty was, I guess, getting at, and that's, and you assert that because the opinion didn't account, or that opinion didn't account for depreciation, it should not have been admitted. But it was, and was done without objection.
There is no objection because the Supreme Court has said, because of his connection with the proper owner, is always permitted to state what he believes the value is.
How is it insufficient?
Well, it's insufficient because it doesn't give due allowance for appreciation and wear and tear.
How do we know that?
And that comes straight out of Dunn. That comes straight out of Dunn. You know, the beauty about Dunn is it's only three paragraphs long, the whole case. And basically it resolves this issue. It says what the Commonwealth's burden is. There we're talking about a type. In those days, a grand larceny was $100. The evidence was we had a 10-year-old typewriter that was in workable condition 3 days before it was stolen, and the jury had to decide to find the defendant guilty that the typewriter was worth $98. And all that evidence came in. Condition of the typewriter, the fact that the purchase price was $150.
Would your argument be different if this witness had, the owner had testified to as follows, essentially: I paid $518 for it. It was in excellent condition. I just replaced the tires and had it repainted. And in my opinion, the depreciation on this bicycle is zero. And today, I think it's still worth $500.
I don't think that would get you anywhere either, because basically, fair market value of a used bicycle is clearly not the same as the price.
You say that, but there needs to be evidence.
Well, that's their burden, and that's why we're having this burden discussion, and that's what Dunn said.
Arguably, when the evidence is that the depreciation value is zero, I don't have to accept that as a fact finder, but if the fact finder did accept it, aren't I stuck with that?
You may be, but of course that wasn't the evidence here, was it? That what you put, you know, you posited a hypothetical, and hypotheticals are good, and analogies are always good. We want to talk about whether it's a chicken or a duck and it's a barnyard animal. We can do all those analogies, but the problem is,
you're into your rebuttal, but you can.
I knew I would be once we got started.
I knew you would be too.
But the simple fact here is the burden is on the Commonwealth to take in due allowance for wear and tear when the type of item that has been proven is subject to such things. Clearly, this is. I'm not saying the bicycle doesn't have any fair market value, but what is the fair market value? Just because he replaced everything on it. It's not the value new. It may be the thrift store value. It may be what the bicycle shop would sell a secondhand bicycle for. Or it may be the new price subject to some type of depreciation table. But all of that, according to Dunn, and Dunn is the grandfather in this case, basically is the burden of the Commonwealth. Now, the defendant, I would agree with you, Judge, had the evidence been, I came to that value because I don't think the depreciation was more than $20 given the condition of the bicycle and the limited amount of wear it had.
When he testified that it was, quote, in excellent condition, isn't that a statement that it had suffered no wear and tear?
Excellent condition means, I mean, that's a quantitative term that basically is subjective, not objective.
It may go to the weight that the trial court gave to it, but it's evidence that there was no wear and tear, thus
well,
no depreciation.
Excellent doesn't mean it wasn't any wear and tear, Judge. As I understand, you're the expert on bicycles, and of course none of that evidence was presented to the court, and the court can't make those findings off the record without evidence. It has to have something to which to make its factual finding, and simply because the owner's a likable guy and seemed to be relatively trustworthy doesn't resolve this issue of value. Clearly a bicycle is subject to diminution in value. We don't even know whether or not the bicycle was $518 and would have been $175 if it was purchased locally. Remember, this was purchased in Greece 4 years ago. We don't have any of that information. So even if you're talking about market value of new bicycle, a bicycle in Greece and a bicycle in the United States are not necessarily going to be the same value. And it is the Commonwealth's burden. I
can tell you for a fact the ones in Italy are more expensive than the ones in the United States.
Exactly. But we can't. There's no evidence of that. There's nothing in the record that establishes that fact. We start with the premise that the Commonwealth has the burden to establish value, not to defend it, to defeat what they put on. Secondly, the Commonwealth, when it puts on evidence of items such as a bicycle that is 4 years old and is subject to wear and tear. And excellent doesn't mean mint, doesn't mean brand new. It means it's subject to 4.5 years of wear and tear. And we don't know what value, whether it's depreciated value or whether it's what this bicycle in excellent condition would sell as a used bicycle on Craigslist. We don't have any of that information. But Dunn says it's their burden. And this is no different than a 10-year-old working typewriter that was worth $150 new and cannot be said without speculating by the trier of fact. And then Dunn's interesting because they were setting aside a jury verdict, not just somebody with a black robe. They were actually setting aside a jury's factual finding that a 10-year-old typewriter that's in working condition.
Well, is it a reasonable inference for a fact finder to draw from the evidence in this case just because the owner says it's in excellent condition, yeah, there's probably some depreciation, but it was new 4.5 years ago, and so it's probably still worth more than $200.
I don't know
that
you can. I mean, there are some reasonable inferences can be drawn. I don't think that's a reasonable inference because it is fair market value. It's not just how you depreciate it. It's what would the thrift store sell it for, or would the bike shop sell it for, or what would you sell it for on Craigslist or put it up for sale in the yard sale down the street. It's fair market value. It's what a willing buyer would sell and a willing buyer would pay and what a willing seller would sell it for. That's a fair market value price. And we're talking about a bicycle. And we know with bicycles like cars and anything else, they have some retention. There's some retained value. There's no argument about that. It's simply that they did not meet their burden to show that at the time of the theft, this $518 bicycle when new in Greece 4 years ago was still worth more than $200. They just didn't establish that. And notwithstanding all the favorable inferences you get to draw on behalf of the Commonwealth in these matters, that inference doesn't carry the sufficiency test here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McCracken.
Thank you very much.
All your time. Ms. Darren, good to see you this morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I think the Court has had several cases this morning where the law has been quite muddled with each time the Court revisits an issue.
We're probably going to make it worse.
This should be an easy lift. Excuse me. This should be an easy lift. The law is clear, crystal clear, that the opinion of an owner of a value is admissible, of the value of property is admissible in evidence, and that opinion is admissible in evidence regardless of the owner's knowledge of market value. At once the owner gives testimony of value, then the weight assessed to the owner's testimony is for the judge to decide.
That is true in cases where the value, the opinion, was based on some other things other than exclusively the cost, the original cost. But doesn't Dunn say that when you are valuing the property based on the original purchase price, there must also be due allowance for elements of depreciation? Isn't that a kind of an exception to the evidence necessary to establish value when only purchase price is considered?
I don't think that Dunn stands for that proposition at all. First of all, I think you can distinguish Dunn on the fact that it was a jury trial versus a bench trial. I think that's an important factor to consider. It was a typewriter that was 10 years old back in 1981. And in that case, the typewriter, when it was purchased 10 years before it was stolen, was only worth $50 more than the threshold value at that time for grand larceny.
Is this a different case if you keep all the facts the same but substitute $250 purchase price for $518?
I think that could be a different case, yes. But I think our first argument is that under the law, and again, I think the Court has blurred this line a little bit because we're relying on owner versus non-owner cases when you're talking about evidence of depreciation. But when you've got an owner testifying that his bike, and he testifies to it twice, he testifies to it on direct examination, and then he testifies to it later on in the case when the judge specifically asks, what was the bike worth? The bottom line is this owner testified that he valued the bike. The bike was worth over $500 when it was stolen. The Court at that point, with that testimony, was in a position to give that testimony weight. And in this particular case, the Court found the evidence was sufficient to demonstrate grand larceny. That should be the end of the Court's analysis. We do have more evidence in this case. We have this owner's testimony that despite this bike being 4 years old, it was in excellent condition. And he also said that it would cost him $500 to replace it. And he didn't say to buy a new bike. He said to replace it. So we have those two pieces of evidence. And then finally, to distinguish Dunn, we have a situation where you've got this bike being $500 estimated, the value as expressed by the owner. And it's over $300 more than the threshold value.
Well, so when he talked about value, he said, I mean, the bottom line, the question was, I mean, it's still going to cost me that much to replace it.
He didn't say buy it new, Your Honor. He said replace it. And I think the reasonable inference there was that he believed it would cost him $500 to replace the bike in the condition in which it was stolen. So we submit that the owner's testimony, the law on this issue is clear. You look at the owner's testimony, it comes in to give it the proper weight. Dunn can be distinguished because you were talking about a 10-year-old typewriter with, and the court inferred that machines lose their value because they don't work as well as they get older. I'm glad I'm not considered to be a machine, but at any rate,
it's still true in my case, though.
Well, I'm not going there. But what I'm trying to say is that I think there are a couple of things that Dunn, you can distinguish Dunn on that point from this case, and also the fact that the threshold was so close and you're talking about an item that was significantly older than the bike in this case.
But, you know, we did a case not too long. It's unpublished. I just was on a panel, recall it, Banks versus Commonwealth, involved some stolen tires and rims. And there was evidence of what these tires cost and rims cost, but no evidence of how far they'd been driven in the intervening time. And we said that, you know, you got to have something to look at depreciation. This bicycle, you know, it was ridden. And tires are one of the elements on a bicycle that are worn and depreciate and affect the value of the bicycle. So, they seem very similar in the missing information.
Well, Your Honor, I would point out two things, and that is that the court has blurred the distinction between owner testimony and non-owner testimony. And you go back and look at some of these cases, Grimes, the copper pipe case, Walls, older Walls, that's 288 Virginia. Walls, these cases are in our briefs. The two TVs case, that was a non-owner case. The Crowder, the crop damage case, the owner didn't testify give an opinion as to value. But then you go back and you look at the cases where the owner is testifying, and I think Lester's the jewelry case, where the owner testifies that the jewelry is increased in value. Well, again, when the owner gives an estimate of value, that comes in regardless of their knowledge of market value, and then the court gives it weight. So I don't think this case, given the cost of the item, what the owner's testimony is to the value, and the owner's testimony is to the excellent condition of the bike, at the excess of $500 level, that if you want to get to that point, that this is a case that was plainly wrong and without evidence to support it, we submit that the evidence was sufficient in this case for the court
We just recently did another case, and I believe it was unpublished too, the cockroach-infested computer. Are you familiar with that case?
I am not, Your Honor. That's the Rusty Pipes case, published.
It was a case where somebody stole a used computer that had been rented out and was infested with cockroaches. And the owner, which was a rental company, put it in a refrigerator to kill the cockroaches, and an employee stole it. And we made it quite clear that even though the owner said, well, it would cost me $700 to whatever it was dollars to replace it, we said that's not enough, because obviously there'd been some depreciation of the computer and nobody discussed it.
We're not willing to take judicial notice the cockroaches added value to it.
It was a buggy computer.
We have this owner testifying that the bike was valued at over $500. We have him testifying that the bike is in excellent condition, not rusty and old and cockroach infested or whatever else might have been in an accident, bald tires. We don't have any of those factors here. We have a very clear-cut, straight case of owner testifying as to value and court properly assigning weight. We ask that the court affirm the grand larceny conviction. Are there any further questions?
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McCracken, you've used up your time, so we'll come down to Greek Council.
Can I use 30 seconds?
No.
Yep.
No, you're
this
done.
This is one of the side one cases.
Mr. McCracken, you're incapable of restricting yourself for 30 seconds.
I simply wanted to call the court's attention to the Knight case.
We're going to come down to Greek Council.